There are a million reasons to listen to Odeo, and this is one.
I want to actually publicly thank Kevin and Jan for their invitation, both this year, 2002 and 99. I was here a few years ago, as some of you were, though most of you, from what I can gather, weren't. We literally bumped into each other in Manly, my family, and I think you had some grandkids with you or something, didn't we? And they'd asked several speakers already, and they'd all turned them down, so... They thought. I'd also like to tell you how important Cooma, just those two Cooma, these two Coomas have been to me, because in 99 I was on the crest of a great change in my life and ministry, and I find myself again now, 2002, the same. It seems like Cooma appears every time I'm about to go into some new chapter. So I'm kind of thankful that there are no more Coomas, I think. But in 1998, leading up to me coming down here to Cooma for the first time, a dear, lovely, godly woman had left the college where I was teaching $2.5 million on the proviso that we use it exclusively to equip missionaries to reach Australia and the world for Christ. And in effect, that was handed over to me in some respect, and we established a school at Morling College called the Centre for Evangelism and Global Mission, and I'm the director of that. I've got millions of dollars in the bank, a brand new building, I've got a staff of four, and basically what we do is we run programs, seminars, classes, internships, whole stack of stuff to basically teach the sort of stuff that we've been doing here this week, only obviously in much greater detail. So I had been doing itinerant ministry all around the planet basically, and just figured I would continue to do it, I suppose. And then in 98, my principal took me to this lady's house, and she said, oh, look, I'd like to help you out. She heard about my vision for a school within a college, and she said, I haven't got lots of cash. She said, I could only write you a check now for about, $500,000. Would that be helpful? And my principal said, my jaw hit the floor. But he's really cool. So he went, oh, yes, every little bit counts, And on that occasion, she said to us, I'm so impressed by this idea of a school just exclusively set aside to train people to think missionally, whether they live in Australia or around the world. I'll put you in my will, she said. Don't get excited. She said, I'm fit as a fiddle. And she died 3 months later. And we just figured, oh, she wouldn't have had time to change the will. But she had, and she'd left us $2 million. Now, my friends, you talk about, a grain of seed falling to the earth and dying. She now equips scores and scores of missionaries. She in effect, keeps me employed and allows me to do this kind of stuff. Her death, little did she know it, has contributed to the extension of God's kingdom beyond. This is a fundamental biblical principle, right? We're going to get hurt. That's just the way it works. We're going to suffer. We're going to die. Some of us might be martyred. But we will not live happy, pleasant lives. That's just the name of the game. But it's actually through our death, our dying, our suffering, blessing emerges right across this planet. If you don't like it, you need to get out now, because that's just fundamentally the way of Christ. Now I find myself back again at Cooma and back again at another change in my life. I'm continuing to run this school of evangelism at Morling College. But Carolyn and I and a group of kind of strange post-church kind of Christians, people who love Jesus and the Lord and want to see the kingdom extended, but they just can't find a place in church. Do you know any kind of weirdos like that? A bunch of us have been gathering in our lounge room and scheming and planning about starting a church. We didn't want to get a cathedral and put a sign at the front and say, yippee-yo, here we are. Well, that just looked like any other church. But we were kind of planning out some subversive, spooky kind of stuff, I suppose. And then someone approached me and they said, we've got a church in Manly. Don't get too excited. There's only about $4 million worth of property there. A beautiful old building. House either side, two-story hall out the back. The church is closed down. How would your group like to take it over and just do whatever you want with it? So So now that I think about it, every time I come to Cooma, someone is giving me millions of dollars. So I've changed my mind. Now I wish there were more. And so as from late January, early February, we're just about to move into this place. We're going to gut the church, turn it into a performance space, art gallery. We want to set up an art studio. We've got a bunch of artists who are part of our group. One of the houses is going to get turned into a healing and transformation centre. Carolyn's heading that up with counselling and GPs, iridologists, audiologists, anyologists you can find. We are going to establish a graphic design lab. We just want to run a whole bunch of stuff out of there, but also move out of there into the community in Manly and minister, particularly kind of through the arts and healing. And we've got a scheme to reach people through book clubs and preschool programs and a whole bunch of stuff. So we're not going to hold sort of fantastic services. Someone was talking to me this week, said, oh, I'd love to come along when you get started. I said, listen, you know, we don't want voyeurs in our church. You know, you either come and make love with us or you don't come at all. It's a kind of sexy illusion when you think about it, isn't it? If you love the people of the kind of the northern beaches on the north side of Sydney and you want a service, you can join us. Not an invitation to you, you're all involved in your churches, but we're only looking for people who want to see this as a mission opportunity, not a place where they can have some kind of clever alternative thing to whatever else they get in church. Do you follow what I'm saying? And so we just find ourselves just about to launch into this new mission, this new church planting plan. We've been scheming it for like months now and building community with the crowd that we've got, and we're about to go. And I want to say to you that Cooma has had significant impact on me both this year and in 99. I mean, in 99 I was already kind of cottoning on to the fact that we need to listen to those who are on the margins of church, those who are most marginalised and alienated, and by and large they happen to be artists and creative people. I was already kind of getting that. And I'd already seen lots of dance and drama and music before. I don't remember actually leaving Cooma 99 thinking, wow, I saw stuff I'd never seen before. By and large, I'd seen that kind of stuff. But the thing that Cooma 99 did for me was that I actually got to meet and talk with artists and listen to their pain and their alienation, in some cases their rage. And listen to the fact that they kind of play in jazz clubs all the time, interact with people who are completely unchurched all the time, and yet don't find any connection between that world and their church world. People who paint or dance in drama groups, theatre groups, have no problems being Christ in the place that they find themselves, but have no bridge back into their church communities. And that alienation, that marginalisation and rage that I heard from some people, and just out-and-out frustration, just fueled me enormously. The last 3 years or so, I've been exploring this, and a lot of the stuff I looked at when I travelled around the world was actually fueled and run by artists, by the marginalised. I've said this to you before already, way out people know the way out. And this is a bunch of way out people. And I think it's up to you to show us the way out. And show us in what ways we actually impact our communities around us. And so I'd like to thank the Crakes. I'd like to thank you guys, if you're here in 99, and again this year, because you kind of sharpen up my vision and you remind me of just how wacky following Jesus. We're going to come to a time of worshipping God around the Lord's table. I'd like to kind of summarise some of the stuff we've said very quickly. This is not a big long talk. Just summarise the stuff that we've said already so that you're all kind of on the money, and then I'll lead us toward the table. I want to remind you that I've said a number of things this week that we need to embrace or re-embrace in our concern to be a subversive way out church in the midst of a kind of fractured postmodern community. And I want to summarise those for you. I wrote some notes. Someone said to me last night, oh, you're really great, you don't use any notes. I've already said all these things before, so this is just to remind you. The first thing is this. We need to recover a missionary mindset in our churches. I want you to not think about ministry. I want you to start using the word mission. When you go out and do youth work, you're doing mission. With me? When you go out and run a dance program, that's mission. Whenever you do anything in order to serve people who are not part of the Christian community, you are doing mission. Don't reserve that word for the person in your church who's gone to Zambia to teach people about Jesus, okay? They have not got dibs on mission. They do mission, but so ought we to. Now, mission means we have to embrace a go-to-them mentality. You've got that already this week? We don't ask them to come to us anymore. Why should we? The whole notion of Christian life, the whole road that I talked about, which is the motif for the Gospels, is that we go to them. Jesus came to us. Jesus' followers went to them. There was no sitting down in Jerusalem and putting on the best program we could so that they'd all come running. They didn't mean to go. They were forced out by persecution. But once they got on the road, they realized this is the name of the game. You live on the road. You walk with one pair of sandals and enough food to get you to the next place. Have a go-to-them mentality. You all with me? Would you stop trying to cook up the best thing that you can come up with to get them to come, knowing they're not going to come anyway? I can tell you this, my friends, I have preached every state of Australia, every major capital city, every major town, every denomination. I've been out there on that merry-go-round. I've done it. I've paid my dues, all right? And I tell you what, there is nothing more soul-destroying for an evangelist to turn up and to have the pastor say, I don't know why there's no non-believers here. We've advertised, we promoted, we put it in the paper, we told them to all invite their friends. I have preached the gospel to more Christians than just about anyone. Let's not fool ourselves, okay? And churches who say, we've had zillions of people converted, look at their churches, they haven't grown any larger than they were 2, 5, 10 years ago. Where are all these conversions? What's happening? Because we are so stuck in a come to us. It's not outreach, friends, it's called in-drag. We're trying to drag them in and they ain't coming. They don't want to come. Most of us don't want to come. Why would they want to come? We need to have a missionary. Second thing, and I hope you got this message also, we need to pray. We have to recover prayer as a missionary strategy. Pray for the sick. Pray for the poor. Pray for those who are in need in your congregation, by all means. But we have to pray that God would raise up more evangelists, missionaries in our midst. Are you with me? We have to pray that God would get us out. As I said, the early church didn't go because they were so noble and it worked out, we need to go. It took persecution to get them out. You know what it's taking to get us out? It's taking the decline of relancy of the church in the West. I can't tell you how many churches I've been to where the minister says, yeah, we're really going to have to kind of do something different. We're going to reach out, otherwise this church is dead. And I think to myself, well, that's a great motivation for wanting to go out, isn't it? It's to keep us alive. Well, it took persecution of the early church. Maybe it takes selfishness to get us out. Who knows? But if you're starting to worry about the shape of your church, worry. Pray like crazy and get out there. Let this be a prayer-soaked missionary enterprise that we embark upon after Cooma 2002. Follow? Third thing, and I really want to emphasize this. If you're going to write notes down, now write this in big, bold letters. Would you stop thinking strategies to reach the lost? Would you just stop it? Would you just stop trying to buy some book from America that can get you to reach the people in Burwood? Would you stop getting CD-ROMs or programs or some hot speaker from somewhere else to come and tell you how to do it? I want you to stop thinking about strategies altogether. And I can't tell you how hard that is for the church to do. We immediately fall back into, oh yeah, but you know, in Latin America, they're turning the world upside down by doing this. Well, good on them. Oh, yeah, but, you know, in Europe, you know, they're trying this. In England, it's Alpha. It's this, it's that, it's the other thing. Would you stop it? You're wasting your money. It's an industry that sells all these kinds of things. Just stop thinking strategies. Stop trying to import some whiz-bang program that's going to unlock your community. Instead of thinking strategies, I want you to think of three things. I want you to think instead of people, places and pathways. I don't want another bloody program that you're going to spend a whole heap of money on, try desperately hard to get the audience or the congregation worked up about, and which is going to have very minimal impact. Are you tired of all that stuff? Have you heard it a million times before? Your pastor just comes back from another trip to America? Here we go, we've got this new program. Stop thinking strategies and do what they did in the early church. They thought about people. They thought about places, and they thought about the pathways that these people walked. I don't mean people like, you know, we live in Saddleback, so we're going to try and reach Saddleback Sam. Are we going to try and reach, Manly Mike? Are we going to try and reach Parramatta Pete? They are not people. Have you worked that out? They are generalizations. You know what I want you to think about? I want you to think about the real people that you know in your community. Nathan and Sarah, Mary, Susan, John, Louise. I want you to think of the people that God has gifted you to. Does that make sense? Name them. Picture them. Take photos of them. I don't know. Put them on pinboard somewhere. Get your church to think about real, live, living people. Not cardboard cutouts, not pretend people, but real ones. Who are they? Where are they? What do they do? Learn to love them and pray for them. You with me? Mission is about reaching people. Lost people matter to God, sure. But let's not talk about cardboard people, but real people. Let's not think about strategies that are imported. Let us learn to love. Who are they in the town of Narendra, Wagga, Melbourne, Shepparton, wherever you happen to be? Who are they? What do they look like and what are their names? And the second thing is, think about places. Where do they go? Where do you meet them? I mean, they're not coming to your church, but where do you have to go in order to meet them? Is it the pub? Is it the club? Is it the beach? Is it the school? I don't go to them. So start thinking about real people and then real places where you're likely to meet them. Did I already mention to you about following the ant trails to the ant nests? I don't know what I've said this week already, but you know, did I say that already? Follow the ant trails, people. Get out there and think about real life people and follow them. You'll meet an awful lot of people at 3 o'clock at the school gate, right? Why aren't we there? Because we're already kind of whipping up some new strategy to reach them. You meet a lot of people at the beach, a lot of people at the club, a lot of people in the sporting world. Where do they go? Follow the ant trails and go where they go. People, places, and then thirdly, pathways. What pathways of life are they on? Are they young? Are they searching? Are they wild and crazy? Are they in midlife wondering what the meaning is? Are they elder? Where are they on the pathway of life and how do we assist them in their search for meaning given their particular context? So stop thinking strategies and start thinking about real live people. The thing I dig about Kuma is that there's no fundamental agenda that unless you do it like this, you're just not really cutting the mustard. The agenda here is, look, we're a bunch of people, you're a bunch of people, let's just learn and live together and grow together. Who is not suspicious of an agenda? Ever been invited to someone's house and out came the Amway presentation? Yeah, you were rushing back there for the next dinner party, weren't you? If there's an agenda like that, you run a mile. How many conferences have you been to where really the chief end is just to sell you all the box and dice? There's no agenda here, and I love it. I love the earthiness, the messiness of Kuma. It's like, here we are, here you are. What could God do or say in the midst of this? Fourthly, can we just learn that the best way to reach people is to befriend them? And don't befriend them in order to lead them to Jesus. There's nothing like becoming a friend with someone and then realizing that you're not coming to the party, so they bail on you. We're going to befriend them whether they want to come to Jesus or not, are we not? We're going to love them and love them and love them and love them. We're going to love them even though they hate what we stand for or what we believe. Find some people and become a friend. Now, someone said to me the other day, well, that's all right if you're a big extrovert and you're out there and charismatic personality, you gather people around you. Listen, if your way of being a friend is to get on the internet and be a friend, if you write letters to be a friend, if you're an introverted personality and you can cope with 2 or 3 friends, not 200 friends, I don't care. Does it make a difference? The quality of friendship is the thing that actually transforms people's lives, I've discovered. People will do anything for a friend. They won't do anything for a program or a strategy. We have to rediscover friendship. And the only way that we become friends with people is that by spending a lot of time with them. By spending a lot of time, we become their friends. Identify some people right now. Make some pledges. I will befriend that person. And just dare to believe that by you being Christ-like in that midst, something is transformed under the Spirit of God. Fifth, develop some common pathways. Find some roads that you can walk with those people. I'll never forget a church telling me about the time when they had to close down their evening service, which is a program, strategy, for reaching people. But it wasn't reaching people. They were down to like a dozen people in the evening service. And 6 of them would go up to be in the worship team. It was becoming a joke, and so they closed it down. You've heard this story before. But when they closed it down, the 12 people that would already have gone to the evening service had to write a covenant. They had to say, in lieu of going to the evening service, In lieu of the hour and a half I'd give to church on Sunday, I will commit myself to the following missional program or missional strategy, missional thing, in lieu of going to church. So you're not off the hook. You don't get to go home and watch 60 Minutes in the Sunday night movie. You get to do an hour and a half worth of mission instead of coming to church. Isn't that a cool thing to do? So often we close down programs and then that's the end of that. Well, this couple I met, so this is what they did. This was their missional outreach kind of stuff. They live in a new housing area and they would strap their baby into a stroller, and then as dusk was happening, late in the afternoon, they would push their baby in a stroller around this new housing area. In new housing areas, people worship grass. Have you noticed that? They've just got this thing about lawn. I don't know what it is, but... And so, you know, late in the afternoon, what are people doing in new housing areas? Watering lawns, trimming lawns, washing cars. You push a baby in a stroller down a street full of people working on their front lawn, and what happens? He said all we had to do was push our baby in a stroller round a few streets, and we've been invited to more barbecues, more parties. We've hung out with more people, we've washed more cars, we've trimmed more lawn than we could ever have imagined. It's not rocket science, is it? It's just not hard, is it? And you can imagine the church cooking up some plan to reach that street for Jesus, and all you got to do is push your baby carriage down there. All you got to do is frequent that same surf club maybe every single week, and sooner or later you'll know the proprietor and all the people who work there, right? You just got to eat in that same cafe once, twice a week. Just go in for a coffee, go in for a meal, and before you know it, you'll know all the regulars, right? Walk some common pathways with people. We make it too complicated. And then sixthly, just be prepared to tell your story. You don't have to become a great evangelist. You don't have to have all the answers to all the questions. If you've just learned how to tell your story and what Jesus has done in your life, and you tell it to someone who you have genuinely befriended, there is magic in the midst of that. Now, I know there's programs where you can learn how to preach the gospel and get the 5 points right and all that. Do those. I don't object to those. But I tell you what, if I know you love me like no one else in this world, I'll listen to anything that you say. And if you tell me that the reason why you've loved me so well and so truly and so faithfully is because you've been loved by the Christ who died for you, whether I buy it or not, I will respect the daylights out of you. You with me? Strip it down, clear it out, and just make it more normal. Do you follow? Now, what I'd like to say to you, as I said to you yesterday, is it will cost you. It'll hurt. If you're feeling a bit sad about this being the last seminar, well, you should be. It hurts. Stuff is supposed to die, and out of it new stuff emerges. The pain or the grief you feel right now is good if out of the fertile ground of your grief something good grows. On the last night that Jesus was free, he had a lamb roast with his best mates. They had a whole lot of bread to sop up all the juices and the gravy, and they had a couple of glasses of cordial. It was a late night, and it was a hot night. And Jesus said to his mates as they were chomping on their bread and their lamb, he said, "See this bread, boys? This is what they're going to do to me. They're going to tear me apart." And as crumbs spilled to the ground, with a belly full of lamb roast and a couple of glasses of claret, they looked at him like, "What does this mean?" And he took this glass of wine. He said, "See this? This is what they're going to do to my blood." He poured it out for them. They didn't have a clue what he was talking about. He prayed and he blessed them. Someone left to do something dastardly. And as they sat there, a little light-headed in the heat, they watched Jesus sweat as he said to them, "Listen, guys, I just can't kind of sit still. I mean, I'm kind of anxious about stuff. Can we kind of take a walk?" And these guys go, "Take a walk? I mean, we just Our bellies are full, our heads are light, it's dark, it's hot. Can't we just lie here? No, he says, no, I just need to get out, I just need to walk. I mean, let's go somewhere. And reluctantly, they spill out onto the cobblestones behind him to take a walk down to a little garden that they used to go to quite regularly, a little garden called Gethsemane. And there, their heads kind of reeling in the heat and the darkness, Jesus says to his mates, I am beside myself. He said, I need you to pray with me. And they said, sure, man, we'll pray with you. You guys ever prayed in bed late at night? And one by one, in his darkest hour, his best mates betrayed him to sleep. Jesus went and woke his best mates. And he said to them, Peter, James, John, I'm overwhelmed by this stuff. I need you with me. I need you to pray with me. Not having a clue what he was talking about. I said, sure, man, we'll pray with you. But even they fell asleep on him in his darkest hour. I'm so sick of images of Jesus that make him out to be some kind of superhero. You know, the demons bounced off him. Stand aside. I'm going to die for the sins of the world. There in that garden, he was overwhelmed by fear and grief and pain. And in his darkest moment, alone, with not a soul to support him or love him, he cries out, oh God, I don't want to die. I don't want them to drag me up that temple. I don't want them to dress me in stupid clothes, bring people to make up lies about me, laugh at me, spit on me, scorn me, tear my face to shreds. I don't want them to open my back. I don't want them to march me up that hill and strip me naked, gamble for my clothes, and anchor me to that cross with nails as thick as my thumb. God, God, is there any other way? In that moment, he begs his Father to find some other way to reconcile himself with you. Does that moment ever scare you? That moment scares the daylights out of me, because I think, imagine if in his humanity Jesus had have given himself over to his fear and refused to have died for us. Can you conceive of such a thing? Don't tell me he wasn't tempted. Don't tell me that he wasn't tempted to abandon you. And yet, hanging over the edge of the precipice, the second half of the prayer is love incarnate, is it not? He says, but God, not my will be done, but yours. He loves you, but he's not beyond being tempted to abandon you. In his humanity, though tempted and afraid, it's in his divinity he chooses to love you to hell and back. Are you with me? And he says to us, those of you who would follow me must take up your cross. It doesn't just mean carry the bloody thing. You know what it means? Die on it. Die on that cross. He's asking you, will you like me weep and grieve? Will you, like me, cry for this nation, for this planet? Will you say, oh God, is there not some other way? And yet I will, Jesus, love these people to whom you've given me. I will, Jesus, serve them. I will. When you take communion, when you eat the bread and you drink this is juice, I'm afraid, you'd better know what you're getting yourself in for. You are partaking of his suffering and committing yourself to same. Let me lead you in prayer. Father, as we come to your table now, a table fashioned for us as an act of service and grace, we are reminded of the extraordinary price that you paid to redeem us. And we commit ourselves afresh to whatever the price might be for us to serve you. Give us courage. Give us strength. Give us clear heads, iron in our soul, imagination, wonder, laughter, life. That we might infect this broken world with a virus called Christ, who brings healing